Okay, so you see there is a timer here. So again, let me remind you where we were. So I'm looking to do sort of the usual tricks of quantum algebra, except in specific algebras for which you can get formulas for the answer. And one specific algebra I've already introduced, and it's a certain eight-dimensional algebra over Q. But the next thing I want to tell you about is about what you get when you set epsilon to zero. So when you set epsilon to zero, you get a certain Lie algebra G0, which is just four-dimensional. And it's even simpler, but mostly I will work with it because it will illustrate the way I work. Okay, the way we work. So it's the algebra generated with by B, C, U, and W as before, with B bracket anything, so B is still central. The commutations relations are written here. So basically, U and W form a Heisenberg algebra with B the central element, and C is like maybe a number operator or something like that. So has these commutation relations. Again, it has a solution of the classical Young-Baxter. And maybe the best way to view it is to view it in the following way. So you look at, you set B to be the two-dimensional Lie algebra with generators C and W, and there is only one non-commutative two-dimensional Lie algebra. So so take that one with the basis in which the commutation relations are as shown here. And then it acts on its own dual via the coadjoint action. You can take the dual with a commutative Lie algebra structure, and then you can form B semi-direct product B dual, and this is this is the Lie algebra you get here. Okay, so this is somehow our G0, our basis Lie algebra. It's very, very far from SL2. And then we slowly perturb in the direction, we go in the direction of SL2, starting from this Lie algebra. Now, in truth, everything we do with this Lie algebra is more valuable than what we will do with G1, okay? Because it will produce the Alexander polynomial, okay? So it's more valuable, but topology already has it by other means since a long time ago, so it's less novel. Okay? Now, how did these algebras arise? Okay? So here's one way to see it. So you can view SL2 as its upper Borel direct sum, its lower Borel, except then you get the Cartan doubled. So you have to mod out by the Cartan. So I will call it SL2 plus. So the thing I'm really approximating is not SL2, but SL2 plus. So this is SL2 with the Cartan doubled. And then the upper Borel of SL2 is, again, a two-dimensional Lie algebra, and you can view it as if it's this one. There's only one non-commutative two-dimensional Lie algebra. But you see, the upper Borel is dual to the lower Borel. The lower Borel is itself a Lie algebra. So by duality, the upper Borel also has a co-bracket. Okay, so a bracket with the arrows going the other direction. So and a thing that has both a bracket and a co-bracket, and they are appropriately compatible, is called a Lie biallgebra. And in fact, from this Lie biallgebra, so here is the Lie biallgebra structure of the upper Borel, namely, so you have a co-bracket going from B plus to B plus tensor B plus, and it's given by the co-bracket of C is 0, and the co-bracket of W is C wedge W. But so in fact, Yeah.
Why don't you call it GL2 rather than SL2 plus?
Because it's not GLN when you generalize it to other semi-simple.
Ah, okay.
to SLN.
But you're not going to generalize
it. I'm not going to generalize it today,
yeah.
But the generalization is in my mind.
Oh.
Okay? So, in fact, going backwards, so suppose you have a Libye algebra. So suppose B plus is a Libye algebra, you can always form its so-called double. The double is just the Libye algebra direct sum its dual. So again, if you're starting with SL, with B plus being the upper Borel, this will be the upper Borel direct sum the lower Borel. And as Pavel didn't say, this actually works for any semi-simple algebra. This can be done for any semi-simple algebra. Anyway, what we do is we do it. So since this works for any Libye algebra, we work with a Libye with the Libye algebra in which the co-bracket is replaced by epsilon. So delta is replaced by epsilon times delta, where epsilon is nilpotent. So epsilon to some high power is equal to zero. Okay. If you take this power to be 1, so if epsilon itself is equal to 0, so if you take k is equal to 0, then the Lie algebra you get is precisely the Lie algebra G0 I mentioned before. Basically, you are declaring that the co-bracket is 0, meaning you take the dual of B plus with a commutative structure, and that's exactly what I did for G0. Okay? If you take k equals to 1, you get the commutation, and you temporarily name the dual of W, U, and the dual of C, B prime. Then you get the commutation relations written here, okay? But now if you look at these commutation relations a little bit closer, you find that B prime plus epsilon C is a central element. Now, central elements are good because if you have a central element, you can pull it out of any formula for free. Okay? So you want to highlight central elements, so I change variables and call this central element B and keep everything else the same. And the result is precisely the Lie algebra G1 that I mentioned before. In other words, G1 is the result of doing this doubling process to the two-dimensional Lie algebra at k equals 1. But with some specific choice of basis. Okay? Now, this is completely general. This could have been done to any semi-simple algebra, in fact, more than any semi-simple algebra. So, in principle, the story can be extended, though I will only work with the with G1, with G0 and G1. Okay. Next, so I want to tell you about the class of formulas that I will be working with, and I first want to tell you about how to describe elements in UG tensor to the S in commutative terms using commutative polynomials, right? This is non-commutative. Okay? So the ordering operator, so ordering a polynomial using some specifications does the following things.
You're going to tell us how to describe every element in there by polynomials or some very nice class of.
The description allows you to describe any element, but I will restrict my attention to specific kind of descriptions. Okay.
And I'm thinking
so,
because Enriquez has a kind of description of like this, where in terms of Lie polynomials. So I'm wondering if this is what you're going to tell us, has the same flavor or not?
No, I don't think so. No.
Okay.
So, no, this is extremely basic. I'm not telling you anything complicated. This is ridiculously elementary, what I'm going to say. And it will remain ridiculously elementary throughout. Okay, but it will get a little bit more complicated at some point when I'll talk about... maybe it's too far away. But, it stays ridiculously complicated, ridiculously simple throughout. Okay?
Is it kind of similar to, or equivalent maybe to, taking this quantization, which you constructed with Kashdan, and working modular some power of H bar?
No, definitely not. It's in your relation in your work with Kashdan.
After some rescaling, maybe.
No, definitely not.
Uh-huh.
So basically, so it's breaking the symmetry between the bracket and the co-bracket. So modding out by some high power of H bar is like multiplying both of these with epsilon by epsilon,
yeah, yeah.
So that if you have too many brackets or co-brackets, you get zero. I'm only multiplying this one by epsilon. Okay? So you get a very rich theory from the bracket perspective,
mm-hmm.
but a very poor theory from the co-bracket mm-hmm. perspective.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Okay? And you see, modding out by some finite power of H is also possible and gives the theory of finite type invariance, which has its good sides, but it's not but it doesn't do what I want. Okay? Okay. So basically, if you have a polynomial, which is a polynomial in variables which are in several copies of your Lie algebra, and then what you do is you plant the variables in this polynomial on several tensor copies of the universal enveloping algebra following the specification. So maybe the best is to show an example. So my polynomial is, so when I say polynomial, I equally well mean power series. Okay, so really a function. So if my polynomial is C1 cubed, U1, C2, E to the U3, W3 to the ninth, and my specifications are on strand X, plant the W3s and then the C1s, and then on strand Y, plant the U1s and then the U3s and then the C2s, then the result will be, so the result will be in two tensor copies of the Lie algebra, so it will be in U of G tensor, in the UG corresponding to X tensor, the UG tensor to Y. In the X side, I will first have the W3s and then the C1s. I have 9 W3s, so I will be putting 9 W's here. And then I have 3 C1s, so I will be putting 3 C cubed here. And I think the rest is clear. Okay? So as I said, this just enables the description of some elements in completed tensor powers of a universal enveloping algebra using commutative terms. Okay? So, example. In the G0 case, the identity element in B minus tensor B plus solves the classical Young-Baxter equation. So the identity element is simply so it's B tensor C plus U tensor W. So C tensor its dual plus W tensor its dual. But I'm thinking of it as, when I write B1 C2, BICJ, I mean B in the ith tensor component and and C in the jth tensor component. So BICJ plus UICWJ is a way of writing an element in UGI tensor UGJ. Now, generally speaking, the solution of Young-Baxter that you get out of a classical Young-Baxter is complicated. But in this particular case of G0, by pure luck, the solution is just the exponential of it, of Rij, of this element. Okay? So the solution of the Young-Baxter element, the thing which you will sprinkle on the strands of your tangle, is e to the BICJ plus UIWJ. Okay? Now, this element does not, well, as written, it does not have a nice description as an ordered exponential.
Can you say something about this by luck?
I can prove it. And I can generalize. Basically, it's true for any co-commutative by algebras.
Yeah, if you take the double of the algebra with the zero co-bracket,
this
is going to be true.
So
it's not luck.
Well, I mean, depends where luck begins, okay? Okay? Anyway,
and it's easy to verify.
So, okay. Now consider this exponential. C and W do not commute. Now, when I exponentiate a thing like that, I have things like B tensor C plus U tensor W to the 7 divided by 7 factorial, and when you expand this, you'll have you'll have words in B and C on the left, tensor, words in C and W, but C and W do not commute. So I want to somehow bring it to a form where all the C's are before all the W's, so that I can give a commutative description of this. And this is the next lemma. So the lemma is that this is actually equal to the ordering of this funny thing. So BICJ plus e to the BI minus 1 over BI times UIWJ, where on strand I you put all the UIs, on strand J you put the CJs and the WJs. And I didn't tell you where to put the B's, because that's part of the point. It doesn't matter where you put them, because B's are central, so they commute with anything. You can just put them wherever. You know, it doesn't matter. I don't care about the ordering, about how where you put them. Okay? So, by the way, what does this mean again? So, the exponential of a sum is a product of exponentials. Again, this is not true here, because here we're in a non-commutative context. But in a commutative context, it is true. So this is really a sum over m and a sum over n of m power divided by m factorial and n power divided by n factorial. The usual rules for exponentiation. Okay? So I'm going to have b to the power m, and then this b to the power negative n, because it's in the denominator, this is this term. Now, here I have something raised, this thing raised to the power n, so this is the e to the bi minus 1 to the n. I'm dividing by n factorial as usual, and then I'm putting the u's on the first strand, on strand i. Now, the u's come with power n, so on strand I have u to the n, and on strand J, I first put the C's and then the W's. The C's come with power M, the W's come with power N, so I have C to the M, W to the N. I just told you how to read an ordered exponential. Okay, Now, why is this theorem true? Or why is this lemma true? Of course, I could prove it, but in some sense, I will be insulting you if I proved it. Because, you see, the only... So, B and U commute, things that occur on different tensor factors commute. The only non-commutativity is the non-commutativity, so the only non-commutativity here is the non-commutativity of Cj with Wj. This is a two-dimensional Lie algebra. The two-dimensional Lie algebra corresponds to the Ax plus B group, or two matrices of the form, what matrices are these? I mean, A, B, 0, 0, I think, something like that. So this is some identity that has to do with exponentiation of 2x2 matrices. Okay? So, I mean, I don't know what the proof is, but it's not going to be very hard. Okay? Anyway, example. So is this what I wanted to say? Oh, no, even before. So since everything is going to be programmed, here's the implementation. So the invariant of a positive crossing put at ij is the exponential of bicj plus, well, this is the formula I wrote before. And then there is also the formula for the inverse and some utilities for how to simplify such things and how to multiply things, such things. This is basically the rule that the product of two exponential is the exponential of the sum. So these are various minor implementation things. Anyway, now suppose I wanted to compute the invariant of this tangle. So I have to put one R matrix at 5, 1, one R matrix at between 2, 4, one R matrix between 3 and 6. And then what it amounts to in our language is that the invariant of the tangle T0 shown here is, well, I take here a product of three R matrices. So here is the first one, the one on 5, 1. Here is the second one, the one on 2, 4. And here is the third one with opposite signs, the one between 3 and 6. And then I place these variables along two strands X and Y. And the order is, so on strand X, you get the 1 and 2 variables in order. And on strand Y, you get the 3, 4, 5, and 6 variables in order. Okay? So this is actually already the value of the invariant. The only problem is that you cannot extract, it's not unique written this way. This way of writing it is not unique. So you cannot extract information out of it. So my goal is to write it in UCW form. So my goal is to find a polynomial zeta, or a commutative power series zeta, described in finite terms, such that in the variables, so zeta is a power series in the variables UX, CX, WX, and UY, CY, WY, such that this ugly quantity is the ordering of zeta, where you put the x's on strand x, the x variables on strand x, and the y variables on strand y. So essentially, this is the PBW theorem, but I want to make it effective. Okay? This is just for implementation. So if I take the tangle to be the product of these, of three crossings, then the answer is the same product of exponentials as before. And I think I already told you what the goal was, or more specifically, I want to write zeta as a scalar times the exponential of a sum of two quadratic forms, where one quadratic is quadratic in bi and ci with integer coefficients, and the other is a quadratic in the UIs and WIs, just like here. So one quadratic is a quadratic in the Bs and Cs with coefficients that are integers, and the other quadratic is quadratic in the U's and the W's, so like these terms, with coefficients that are rational functions in the BIs and their exponentials. Now, you know, this may appear complicated, but you should think about it this way. Tensor products of spaces grow exponentially, but the number of quadratics grows quadratically. If you have a quadratic in n variables, you just need to know n squared coefficients. So you need to know n squared rational functions, and in fact, the complexity of these rational functions is also bounded. So you need a relatively small amount of information in order to specify this zeta. Okay. Now, so my strategy is to, I have an expression, and it is ordered according to some complicated specification. What I want to do is to tell you how to swap two variables in this specification, and what the effect will be on the expression. And then the idea will be to swap all variables into canonical order, and then read out the answer, and read out the zeta. Okay? So I need a single big lemma, which tells you how to swap variables. Okay? So, under the commutation relations that we have, the claim is, okay, first of all, ignore the arrows and ignore the n here. The claim is the ordering of e to the gamma c plus beta u in the uc order. By the way, what does it mean? It just means, so, you know, this is a commutative exponential, so this is the same as e to the gamma c times e to the beta u, and I'm telling you, put the u's before the c's. So you get e to the beta u, e to the gamma c. And I claim that it's equal to e to the gamma c plus e to the gamma beta u in the cu order. Again, what does this mean? I should have said that gamma and beta are scalars. So what does this mean? Again, this is a product. This is a product of exponentials, and I put the c1 before the u1, so it's the thing written here. Now, and likewise, there is some relation for c and w. Yes?
So where did that initial expression come from that you kind of...
Which initial? This one?
For this invariance. So you said you can calculate this invariance with this...
This?
Yeah, this one, yeah.
Oh, so it came from... It came from the assertion that the exponential of Rij, that this exponential satisfies the Young-Baxter equation, and then that if you order by this sort of ordered exponential technique, e to the Rij can be written as the ordering of this exponential in this order. Okay? Okay. So, where am I? Here. So, okay. So, again, I'm not... Once it's understood what I need to prove, right, I need to prove that this product of exponentials is equal to that product of exponentials under the commutation relations that C and U, the commutator of C and U is equal to U. Once I told you that this is what I need to prove, the proof is silly. Or that this is what I want to prove. The proof is silly because it's a two-dimensional algebra, so it's just a calculation in the AX plus B group. Okay? next relation. So again, why am I telling you all of these relations? Because I want to tell you how to switch from ordering a UC to ordering a CU, to the order CU. So and in fact, I've just defined an operator, the NCU operator, which tells you how to switch from the UC order to the CU order. I should have called it NUC. I think I failed to. Never mind. My naming convention is wrong between these two. Okay. Here is a similar relation. So I claim that if you write e to the alpha w plus beta u in the w order, you get the same as e to the minus b alpha beta plus e to the alpha w plus e to the beta u plus beta u in the uw order. What does it mean? Let's translate it to simple expressions. So, okay, e to the alpha w plus beta u in the WU order just means e to the alpha w e to the beta u. And I'm asking myself, is this equal to, so what does this mean? So the b alpha beta commutes with everything else, right? Because alpha and beta are scalars, b is a central element. So this is just e to the minus b alpha beta, which I can write in front of everything else. Or at the end, it doesn't matter, it's a scalar. And then I have e to the alpha w, e to the beta u in the uw order. So in the opposite order. So e to the beta u, e to the alpha w. And this is under the commutation relation, uw is equal to b. So basically, this is in the Heisenberg algebra, how to commute exponential, and this is the exponentials, and this is the so-called Weyl commutation relation. So it's easy. Maybe I'll skip the next one and only go to the next one, which is actually quite hard and not so well known. So let me tell you first of all, what does it mean? Okay? So Pavel, this one you don't know, I claim. These two you knew. This one you don't know. Okay? So, what does it mean? So, again, it's written in the Heisenberg algebra because it's just the algebra generated by U and W. And what it says is the following. E to the delta UW, E to the delta UW in the W order, WU order, just means that you look at the sum of 1 over n factorial, and then delta to the n, and then you put the w's, and then you take uw to the n, so u to the n, w to the n, but put the w's ahead of the u's. So it's w to the n, u to the n. It's not a product of exponential, right? It's an exponential of a product, something else. And the question is, is this equal to the thing written here, which is nu, where nu is 1 plus b delta to the power minus 1 times e to the, where am I, here, nu delta uw in the uw order. So sum nu delta to the power n over n factorial u to the n, w to the n. Okay? So that's not a relation that's commonly occurring in quantum mechanics. Okay?
But so delta is just a number.
Delta is a constant, yes.
So yeah. How can this be hard?
I didn't say it's hard. I said it's... In fact, let me tell you why it's easy. But it's easy for reasons you don't see very often. Okay, so basically think of it as if, so, you know, so think of it this way. Think of U as equal to, what did I do it over there? U is differentiation with respect to X. So think of W is multiplication by X, or B times multiplication by X.
Yeah, let me just check it. It's an identity, simple identity.
No, it's cute identity. Okay. It's simple, but it's cute. Okay. And then this is sum of delta to the n, b to the n, over n factorial, multiplication by x to the n, d to d x to the n. And if you look at it, this is like the Taylor series, right? But in the Taylor expansion, so you have d to d to the n, but this thing here is delta x to the power n. So if you take this and evaluate it on some function f, and then evaluate it at the point x, what you get is f of what? Y, not to be.
I mean, the way I would check this identity, I would apply it to x to the to the alpha.
Yeah, and then
you just get numerical identity, and you check it.
Yeah, you're right. You can also check it by working with binomial coefficients, and I think basically this is the expand and crunch version.
Yeah.
Okay, but no, I think I want it to as a function of f of x. So you, but by Taylor series, this is f of x plus delta x, so it's f of x plus delta b x.
Yeah.
Okay, which is f of x of 1 plus delta b times x. So it's a dilation operator. Okay? Yeah. Now, what is this operator? This operator involves u and w in the opposite order. So it's like sum of differentiation to the n, 1 over n factorial, and then multiplication by x to the n. This is, again, not something that you usually see. Okay? But you see, the adjoint of this will reverse the order. So this is the adjoint of a dilation operator. The adjoint of a dilation operator is dilation by the inverse amount, but there is also a Jacobian. So the Jacobian is this nu here. Okay. The Jacobian is the prefactor. So I'm not saying it's hard. In fact, I'm asserting everything is trivial, but it's a nice assembly of trivial things. Anyway, so this tells you how to switch one type of expression from the WU order to the UW order, and this turns to be the key to switching more complicated expressions. So if you want to switch beta u plus alpha w plus delta u w from the wu order to the uw order, then that's what you have to write as the polynomial, as the commutative thing. Okay? And then two more points. First of all, if you want to, if the same letter appears twice, you can just combine the two letters. You can just replace it by a single occurrence of that letter. And all you have to do is within zeta to identify these two variables. That's completely clear because any letter commutes with itself. Okay? And then there is another tricky point, and this is that I told you that the alphas and the betas, and in fact also the deltas, so the alpha, betas, and deltas that appear here should be scalars, but and gammas, I guess. But in fact, they don't really have to be scalars. They can also contain other variables u, I, and w, j. I mean, namely, not the ones that you commute, because these are auxiliaries. These live sort of in other parts of the expression. Commuting a specific u and a w doesn't see the other variables. Okay? So basically I told you, so therefore there are enough rules here if you look at it, how to recommute an arbitrary quadratic from one order to any other order. And that's all I needed. So, one last thing. Suppose I already brought two strands to canonical order. So if I brought, you know, one strand so that all the U's come before all the C's, come all before the W's, and then in another strand, and I have all the U's before the C's, before the W's, and I want to combine them and rewrite it as something in which all the U's are before the C's and before the W's. So basically, so I have two things, a UCW followed by another UCW, and I want to write it as a single UCW. Well, what I need to do is to swap the W across the U, you get something like that. Then you have to swap the C across the U and the C across the W here, and then all the variables are paired, and then you can just merge them, combine them. So this gives you a rule for the stitching. Okay? And again, all of this can be implemented, and if you look at the implementation, these are the formulas that I wrote in the lemma turned into computer code. There is really nothing here. And then I can compute. So if you take the tangles that I wrote before and apply to it stitch 1 and 2, calling the result 1, and then stitch 3, 4, and 5, and 6, calling the result 3, that gives me this horrible expression, which is the value of the invariant, which is the invariant of the of that T0. Now, the moment you have a stitching formula, okay, first of all, you need to verify that it works. So you need to verify meta-associativity. So I have a program, I can feed it with things with generic coefficients, and then apply the rules that will correspond to meta-associativity, hit enter, and the computer tells me that I made no mistakes. Even better, I can take the product of three crossings, stitch them in one way, or the product of three crossings, stitch them in another way, and compare the two results, and again, the fact that I get true tells me that this satisfies Rademeister 3. So now I know I have a not invariant. Even if my reasoning was wrong, my program verified that it's a not invariant. So I can take some complicated not, write it as the product, so this is a not with 8 crossings, so I'm writing it as the product of 8 R matrices, or more precisely, 8 quadratics. Then I stitch 1 to n, calling the result 1, where n runs from 2 to 16. So essentially, I stitch everything. And this is the output. And you can recognize here the Alexander polynomial of the knot. So all I did was to compute the Alexander polynomial. Now, that's not what I really wanted to do. I wanted to do the one-smidgen case, the G1 case. Okay? So practically everything is the same, with some small exceptions. Here is the small exception. So if you want to commute a quadratic from the WU order to the UW order, first of all, when you commute U's and W's, you sometimes get C's, and you have to decide where to put them. But they're always multiplied by epsilon. So you have to write the result in some specific ordering of U, C, and W. So I chose the U, C, W order. And then the claim is that what you get is the same answer as before times 1 plus epsilon something. And this something is what you get from the epsilon C's that occasionally occur. It's a horrible mess, but you compute it once and for all, and that's the answer. So you learn how to commute one thing across the other. There is still a, oh, by the way, here is this horrible mess entered. type thing. But there is still a problem. And the problem is that the result here is no longer a Gaussian, but it's a Gaussian with a perturbation multiplied by a polynomial. So it's not enough that I learn how to reorder Gaussians, I need to reorder perturbed Gaussians. And the solution, the trick, is to borrow something from quantum field theory. So if you have a polynomial in CNU multiplying an exponential of gamma C plus beta U, you can just write it as the differential operator. You substitute d to d gamma into C and d to d beta into U. This is exactly like how Feynman diagrams are created in perturbation theory, in quantum field theory. So you can write it as a differential operator acting on this. The differential operator you can pull out of the exponential of the ordering. This is like pulling it out of the integral in Gaussian integration. And then you can use the old formula, and then you can pull it back in. So you get a formula for reordering polynomials, and the formula is in terms of Gaussian of differential operators. So you can do the same in the UW case, and now you know how to reorder anything you wish. It remains to find what the R matrices are and also what the quarks are. And this you do just by solving many equations. It's complicated, you just solve the equations. So first of all, Z's are the R matrices, Z's are the quarks, and I should have said that there is some pragmatic simplifications that you do. You change variables in minor ways to make the results appear simpler. And this is the program you get. Here it is evaluated on the trefoil. And I think I'm running out of time. So in fact, I think I have run out of time. So I'm
only maybe you sketching. Can talk about the two release then.
Yeah. So. The complexity is roughly n to the 5, where n is the number of crossings. Here it is analyzed. Basically, here's how you read out row 1 out of the result. Here is a table of the results. I claim it's a powerful invariant. So, not only it's quickly computable, it actually turns out to be more powerful than all other invariants that can be computed in reasonable time.
So Homfli PT? So
Homfli PT, it's more powerful than Homfli PT.
But the Homfli PT, doesn't that include Jones, for example?
So it includes Jones, but not color Jones. So you see, Jones is exponential time computable, but it can still, but by luck, it can be computed for relatively large knots. Okay? Collar-Jones cannot be computed for large knots, but this section of the Collar-Jones can be computed for very large knots, and it is more powerful than anything else.
Okay, and did you obtain a new result in knot theory already?
Well, so there are a few better genus bounds than what the Alexander polynomial gives, but unfortunately these were already found earlier by Higgard floor techniques. So no, not yet.
Not yet, but you're
okay,
on the way.
But it's completely fresh, right? And somehow the point is that you could.
It wouldn't be very hard for you to work out moduli epsilon cubed, right?
I haven't done it yet. Anyway, you asked about the to-do list. So, clean up and write up, implement. There are various questions about that. The results are better than they a priori should be. So in some places you get polynomials instead of rational functions, and we don't fully understand why. There are all sorts of things of that nature. There should be, so you know, I wrote it for SL2, but you could have done it for SL3. And if you do it for SL2, then there should be two central variables, and then you should get a two-variable polynomial already for k equals 1. So it seems worthwhile to find out what it is. And by the way, for higher n's, I expect, well, for various external reasons, I expect to stop at two variables for k equals 1. For k equals 2, you should stop at three variables. And
k?
So
what is k?
K is the power of epsilons that you divide by. And so, yeah, there is, maybe I'm not sure I want to go through all of it, but okay. There is a long to-do list.
Okay.
And I think I'll stop with my usual propaganda, and I'm sorry for having you go through this pain, and but, okay.
Let's see. Any questions?
Well, I guess let's think. I'm gonna ask you lots of questions, but later.
Okay.